Dude, have you played around with Cursor?
I've been using Cursor to write an app.
Dude, it is unreal, is it not?
It's pretty interesting. So,
Dude, why do you guys say it like that, right as I take a sip of my coffee? Hey guys, our sponsor, Project Discovery, has dropped a new tool in collaboration with Google's own Mandiant team called TLD Finder. Okay, picture the sub finder, but for top level domains. Need I say any more? Check it out.
Listen, dude, I'm getting roasted.
Dude, you're just rolling up to Twitter like, all right, guys, I'm freaking expensing these Genshin Impact pies, dude. What a tweet, man. What a tweet.
Listen. It's in policy, okay? I get a per diem for dinner. Uh-huh. I chose to spend it at McDonald's, okay? I open the McDonald's app and there's Genshin Impact apple pies for sale.
How do you say no to that? How do you say no to that?
I ordered them and I was like, damn, I just realized I'm going to have to file an itemized expense report for the Genshin Impact apple pies.
Oh my gosh, dude. That's amazing. I'm looking at this little like side picture here in Riverside where like it shows your just the, I think the thumbnail, the first frame that happens when you loaded up your camera, dude. And it looks like you just rolled out of bed in your hair. Okay. All right, guys. Sorry about all that. Okay. Joel, where are you at, man?
I'm in LA.
You're in LA.
Yeah, I'm in LA for a couple days. I'm here for a conference, so
nice.
I'm just popping in and out. But yeah, we're back on that East Coast, West Coast time difference.
Yeah. It works out well, to be honest, because you're an early bird. So, yeah,
it's not too bad, but it was a little bit difficult getting myself out of bed this morning, I will say.
I'll say it works out well for me.
You're like, no. 8 a.m. I'm like, 5 a.m.
5 a.m. Oh my gosh, that's great, dude. Well, just to give Joel an out here, there was a little bit of miscommunication this week, and Joel did not know that he was going to be on the pod this week. So,
Joel, it was like, you ready to record tomorrow? And I was like, yeah. No.
So thanks for showing up, dude. Thanks for doing the homework, and you got the AirPods today. So if this is your first episode, whoever is listening, I'm sorry, this is not our normal audio quality, but we show up,
dude.
We
one
show
thing up I will say week. One thing I will That's say what we do. there was a rumor I don't know if this is true or like when it's going to happen, but apparently Apple's going to be rolling out a change at some point where the AirPods are no longer going to switch into handset mode when you're using the microphone, and they'll stay on like the 48 kilohertz or whatever. And what I think it's going to happen like over Thread or something.
What does that mean?
So when you're, so normally like your headphones, like, you know how like there's an audio quality difference when you hop onto a call.
Yeah.
It's because it's using both the microphone and it's using both input and output, so it runs at a lower bit rate.
Oh.
And so that's like why it sounds like shit, where if you set the, like if I set it to only use the audio and to use the microphone from my laptop, it'll switch back to sounding good. So Apple's apparently making a change where they're going to make it so the AirPods can do both without needing to switch quality. I don't know. We'll see,
man.
I saw a tweet about that a couple weeks ago.
I said yes, but I've never used AirPods in my life, so I have no idea what you were talking about. Yeah, I've heard that they're pretty decent.
Yeah, I'm a pretty big fan. I actually just bought. Well, I have mixed experiences. My Maxes, I just had them break, and thankfully they were under Apple Care, and they fixed them very quickly. But during that process, I then had to buy a new pair of Pros, the little tiny ones. And I've had a pair of Pros for a while, and I'm quite happy with them because I like storing them in my pocket.
It's just like, I lose headphones so fast too. I don't know what it is. Like, I'm not a particularly irresponsible person when it comes to like keeping things. Like, I never lose my wallet, lose my headphones. Phone, my keys. But for some reason, headphones are just not important to me. Like, and it's I just always get these like same $40 pair, you know, because it's, you get a good enough quality where it's like, okay, this is good quality. But if I lose it, it's not like, oh, this hurts, you know?
That's interesting. That's interesting. No, I love them because I just throw them in my pocket and I have them with me like everywhere I go.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well,
I digress.
Shout out to Ben for all the AirPods that he's lost. We know that that's a legacy of his. But all right, so I meant to start out this episode a little bit differently, Joel, but I'll do a little story time.
I saw this story and I got some questions, but I'm gonna let you go ahead,
dude. This is just the hacker mentality. Okay, I think this is the I just wanted to share this story so that we can talk about the struggle that hackers feel internally, ethical hackers, right? Because I'm driving down. Actually, I'm not driving. I'm sitting in the passenger seat. I almost always drive our car when Mariah and I are together, right? But for some reason this time, Mariah's driving. And this asshole cuts her off completely. And like, she has to slam on the brakes. And I'm looking at this person. I was like, I can see this license plate very clearly, right? I'm like, man, wouldn't it be cool if I like if I could just pick a couple black hat things to do? How sick would it be to just be able to hand out like road retribution for all of these like terrible sins that people commit while driving, right? So I could just say like, that guy is gonna get like a ton of toll fines or something like that, right?
And just like, Justin, go in. You need to work for the Department of Transportation.
I never do it. I'm purely on the white hat side. But how cool would that be to just be able to be like, I got your license plate number. You're done for, buddy. You're done for,
you're
bucko.
Done, bud. You know? You're done, bud. All right. You're not that guy, pal. Yeah. That's,
you know,
that's,
and I know I'm not going to shout out any hackers in particular, but I know a couple hackers that have like some automation frameworks surrounding license plate numbers and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, I know the same one you're talking about. Glad you phrased it that way because I was going to call them out by name.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, it would be cool if there was some way to, you know, if it wasn't just read, if it was write. You know, if we could just be like, you deserve a fine. You're going to get fined. So
maybe it's time to do an ethical hacking endeavor on the DMV.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Well, it's not. And the thing is, man, I'm not a particularly road ragey person. So I figured I'd share this on the pod because it surprised me a little bit. I'm like, why do I want to do that? You know, like, and I think it's because they cut off Mariah. You know,
every once in a while it happens to me. I get a road rage incident. Yeah. Well, incident, maybe that's not the right way to phrase it. I'm not like getting out of my car and yelling at someone. Usually it's the other way around.
Oh my gosh.
But it's not because I've caused anything. It's because like I'll flip them off and then they'll flip me back off and then it just escalates.
Dude, whenever anybody flips me off, I do the heart. Back
that's
at them.
Crazy,
that
bro.
That just gets them. That gets them.
That's crazy, bro.
So if you flip them off, like they're like, oh, well, screw that guy. You know, he flipped me off. I flipped him off. Ugh. But if you give him the heart, you know, if you hit him with the little Korean drama heart, then they're like, like, what is this? What is wrong with, you know, it gets in their head a little bit more, right? You know, am I wrong? I'm not wrong.
Yeah, man, that's super intimidating. You're right. I feel threatened.
Yeah, you're welcome for that. All right, dude. Yeah, well, we'll leave that at that. But so let's hit some of these topics. We got a pretty lean episode today, guys. I'm just coming off a live hacking event. The show and tells were just like an hour ago, so I am feeling a little bit high from those because it's always amazing to see what the other hackers come up with. And I will also give a shout out to Cosmin, Inhibitor 181, because him and I both. There, in this live hacking event that we're working on, there's a massive scope. Massive. And him and I both happened to coincidentally choose the same little minimal application that was just a small part of the scope, right? And just went ham on that for the whole live hacking event. And we both found 15 plus bugs. Cosmin's substantially more critical than mine, but we didn't dupe at all.
I was going to ask. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, and it blows the mind a little bit because like Cosmin and I, you know, we've had vuln overlap before, but it's just because I remember getting to the end of this event just a couple days ago and just being like, wow, I think I found everything that could be possibly found on this app, you know? Like, I know everything about this app. Like, ain't nobody can teach me nothing about this app. And then Cosmin comes in there with, like, 6 crits, you know?
Yeah, then the professor walks in.
Seriously, and I'm like, and he just found some way to get around a core protection, and it just unlocked a bunch of new scope.
Nice. So, that's cool.
Yeah, it just goes to show, man. Even if you know, I preach a lot on the pod about going deep and becoming the world expert on an application, right? And you know, I'm going to say, I thought I did it, you know, at this event. But there's always more to learn about it, man. There's always more to learn about it.
I've been parahacking on a couple different random, like, public programs.
Yeah.
And we've been duping like crazy.
On
stuff that, like, we shouldn't be duping on either. And it's like, we're duping by, like, 2 days. And it's, like, super annoying. And, like, I've never had this many dupes before. Like, I never dupe at live hacking events, ever.
Yeah.
And, like, this time around, I am.
Are you duping, like, with your pair? Like, with the person you're working on it with, or?
Yeah, we're collabing. So yeah. we're duping on, like, random people.
Oh, you're duping on somebody else.
Yeah, somebody else.
Dude, that's super annoying. And it's close, too. It's not, like, something that the program, yeah, like, lets,
yeah,
it for.
Like, there was one, I was talking about this in the Discord, that, like, originally it was duped by, like, 2 years, and I was like, okay, that's super annoying, like, that this was open for 2 years, and then, like, they reopened it, and we're like, oh, actually, no, this isn't a dupe, and then, like, a couple days later, they duped it again on a different bug that was 2 days before ours.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, dang, dude, can't win here.
So demotivating. I don't understand, you know, like, I understand that they have to do that, right? I understand that it's a part of their job to go in and be like, actually, this is a dupe. But, like, if you do something like that where you open up and you undupe it and then you redupe it again a couple days later, like, you got to understand, if you have any empathy, you got to understand what that does to the hacker.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Like, why, I mean, like, it's terribly demotivating.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know, man. I did get a little bit of a shot in the gut, though, when I thought I had really, like, wrecked this application, and then Cosmin comes in there with, like, 6 crits.
Do you feel like the bypass that he found was something you would have found?
No, I mean, I think I would have found it eventually, but the thing is, I specifically decided to ignore a certain part of the application because I thought that the impact was not going to be, I'll just be a little bit more clear about it. I decided to ignore because I'm like, you know what? The impact here is a little bit low. I kind of want to go for the juicy juice, right?
Yeah.
ATO. And so I ignored that part, and there was an additional piece of impact that could be achieved by using a different component within that environment. So I might have to bleep some of that. We'll see. Sorry if I do, guys, but it was a very creative approach, and I think, you know, at the end of the day, he just knew more about that part of the application than I did, and that's because I didn't go as deep as I could have. And that's the thing that I love about these life hacking events, man, is you always get to see how the other hackers' minds work, and you get to fine tune your own hacker intuition and your own, you know, brain radar there. And then next time I'm going to be a little bit more thorough about this for sure.
Nice. Hell yeah, dude. That's awesome.
Yo, y'all, exciting announcement real quick. We are finally launching the CTBB podcast swag store. Yeah, that's right. The shirts that Joel and I have been wearing on the pod for the past couple months will finally be available for y'all to purchase at ctbb.show/swag. We gave out quite a few of them at DEF CON, but if you didn't get your hands on one, or maybe you want some more, then definitely check out the swag store. Also, if you're a critical thinker on Discord, then check the Discord channel, because you'll have a discount code available for you there. Or maybe this is a good opportunity for you to sign up and become a critical thinker if you're not already, because you'll get a great discount on the swag if you do so. All right, cool. I think that's a wrap. Anything else I need to tell you about that? I don't think so. All right, cool. Back to the pod. Let's go. All right, so we got a couple things. We got a couple write-ups. We got a couple gadgets. We got some cool research that I stumbled upon. But first, I wanted to go ahead and handle a community request here from NBK_2000 on Twitter, saying, tell us about some of the stuff you're doing with Cursor after I tweeted about Cursor. Dude, have you played around with Cursor?
I've been using Cursor to write an app.
Dude, it is unreal, is it not?
It's pretty interesting.
Dude, why do you guys say it like that? Right as I take a sip of my coffee.
Yeah. So I used it quite a bit over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
The thing is, it can be really good for certain things. I think a lot of the hype around it was very misleading.
Wow. Okay, you know, we're gonna have different takes on this. Go for it. Yes, you're an actual dev, so maybe.
And for what it's worth, I've been using it to write a complicated iOS app for the last couple weeks.
Mm.
So it's not like I'm not experienced with it. I've gone back and forth with it quite a bit, and I'm now at the point where I'm like fully not using it. I actually uninstalled it the other day because I'm now like I'm just on manual development, and I'll explain it a little bit why. But Cursor, so early on when I first saw it, like a lot of the hype being drummed up, they were like, check this thing out, there's Cursor Composer, you just give it this MD file, like you know describe like how you want your backend app to work and whatever, and then you just feed it into this and it'll go and create it. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. So I went and I was testing with it, and I was like, oh, you know you can actually do this. But I was having trouble like replicating those results to the same extent until I started taking a closer look at those demo videos. And when you look at the demo videos, the markdown file that they provided to Cursor in the demo was create a file called server.ts with the following content. And it's literally just a code block. And like they wrote the code for it. That's not like, so
that doesn't make any sense at all.
So that aside, right? Mm. Like taking that with a grain of salt, like the fact that it can actually get close, pretty cool. You know, like it's very interesting technology. You know, I think like the context stuff is probably where the biggest hurdle is. Like there's just so much context where you get to a point, and this is why I've switched to manual development, where there's too much context for a GPT, especially a free one, to be able to do anything meaningful with. And you'll get to a point where it starts to clobber itself, where it'll, you know, change things or doesn't have enough context to keep things the way they are, or to keep functionality the same. And like as a human, like, you know, like I don't want to change this, I just want to add this one thing, but it will like change other parts of the application just to do this one thing, or it'll, you know, re-add a class that already exists, even though it should know that it exists, just for like, you know, to get rid of an error message.
Yeah.
So it'll do like a lot of that kind of stuff, which is a little bit tricky. You know, as a whole, it's a very, very cool piece of software.
Yeah. So I think you're coming, I think our difference in perspective here is coming from the fact that you're using it to actually code a large application, right? The project you're working on is a lot more advanced than anything I'm working on, right? And it's also in a language I think that probably I theorize the AI has less experience with. For me, I'm writing mostly HTML, CSS, JavaScript, Python, right? Those are the ones that I'm using it for. And
yeah.
And I'm most of the time what I'm coding are proof of concept exploits, right? So I'll essentially say to it like, and I'll have like cool ideas for this is the cool part, right? Because for a hacker, like I often have these cool ideas for my proof of concept bugs, especially my web stuff, that kind of utilizes common flows of the web and like a user's tendency to be able to or to wait on a page, you know, for a certain amount of time, right, without realizing anything's happening. So I can say like, hey, generate a loading bar that takes, you know, 20 seconds for it to load. And if I had to code that myself, I'd be like, I'm not going to do that. But because I can just tell Cursor, hey, generate that, and it does it, it makes my proof of concepts much more beautiful and much more realistic to the program, where they can come to this page and be like, oh yeah, I didn't even realize I was sitting on this page for 20 seconds. And something's happening in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So before I was actually having it write an iOS app, a lot of the experimentation I was doing with it was around like web apps and stuff.
Yeah.
And just having like, I won't go into the rabbit hole. It's a very dumb rabbit hole, but we were trying to have it write a very silly web app.
Oh my gosh.
I can't even go into the details because it's too much. But the point is, it can do a lot of really impressive stuff. I think one of the more impressive things is how it can integrate with libraries. So you'll be like, you know, I want to do this thing. And instead of like expecting that it's going to home roll like image recognition or something. It'll
Yeah.
just pull some JavaScript library that actually does it really well, and it'll just implement it, and it just works. So there were definitely like for more basic web apps, it's really good at that kind of stuff. And like, a couple files, like you said, like, maybe you need a backend server that does some specific flow, and you just want like a little front end, like an HTML thing that, and could you do it yourself? Sure. But can you do it in 10 seconds?
Yeah,
No. So,
exactly. So
Cursor's kind of nice for that.
here's the thing that I'll shout out about Cursor to the hackers out there. Like, for us, the end goal is not to create some majestic code that is running very high efficiency, very optimized, you know.
Well, speak for yourself.
Okay, well, most of the time when we're coding our proof of
I'm not here trying to make a
concepts.
million bucks with my
Oh, I'm not, hey, no, like,
iOS
you're, I mean, you're Devin. I'm talking about us as hackers,
app,
right? Most of the time our goal is to just build POCs. This thing is very good for getting a rough solution to a problem. And also adding some of those nice to haves that make it a lot more clear. For example, I'll just share this little tidbit. One of the things that is really negative about GDPR and all of these like cookie stuff, like we got to accept the cookies, is that everybody is just tuned that out completely. So it is extremely easy to harvest a click by just popping up a little box saying, like, do you like cookies? You don't even need to say anything else, just say cookies. They're just like
cookies.
accept, 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 right? So it's extremely easy to harvest a click in that scenario. And so in order to make your proof of concepts more reasonable, more beautiful, more convincing to the team, which we've already talked about, can really increase your bounty. I think my experience has been up to 1.5 times your bounty if you do a really well good
Well, let me just throw
POC.
a little anecdote in here. I woke up
What?
this morning and I checked my email inbox, and I had a beautiful POC.
Oh
Okay,
no,
for the record,
Joel.
like I said, I've been going deep on some applications. We went through the effort of writing an entire backend server to handle and proxy requests, all this stuff. Okay, I get a notification this morning. Tree Edger has updated severity from critical 9.0 to none.
No, Joel, please. Okay.
Report has transitioned to pending program review.
Dude, we do have a little bit of like good cop, bad cop thing going on here with Bug Bounty, because I feel like I'm relentlessly optimistic about Bug Bounty, and I'm like, this is the great shit about Bug
Just
Bounty.
like
And
I
like
love getting duped so I can see where I messed up, and I'm like, when I get a dupe, I want to quit hacking.
Oh my God, dude, I love it, man. Yeah. No, I mean, and not to say it's always the case, but using Cursor AI to TLDR it, for anybody who didn't follow us through that monstrosity of a conversation, Cursor is really good for building POCs that have nice to haves, especially in the web world, and also just making quick modifications to your code, so you don't have to go look up all these things. Because us as hackers, we're not necessarily writing the code every day. We're reading the code, we're playing around with it, and we can get it there. It just takes more time. I think Cursor is an excellent tool for hackers because it takes away that need to know all the syntax, all the flows, and it does it a lot of it if you can describe the general concept.
Right, for sure. Like, it definitely, and like I said, it doesn't have to be. I think, unfortunately, when there's hype, clearly that video that I was talking about, like, they want it to work perfectly, so that's why it was done in the way that it does, so they can say, write the backend for this app using this file, and it just works, right? Quote unquote, just works. But like, it just works because you did all the heavy lifting. That being said, you can also get it to do that stuff, right? And it can do a good amount of work and pull in a lot of context just out of the box, like free, using Claude 3.5, like, very, very, it's very cool, very, very interesting stuff. I honestly, the biggest thing that I like struggle with is I pay for ChatGPT Premium or Plus or whatever, and I have like access to O1 preview and stuff. I just want to hook it into that, and I don't want to pay for like the API stuff, cause, which is like a totally different, because it's like tokens and stuff.
I mean, do you think it's better? Do you think like
I
OpenAI
don't know.
stuff
I
is?
mean, here's the thing. Whether or not it's better, I'm unsure. The fact that I'm paying for it is really all it is. So like,
Oh
I'm paying
man.
for a version that should be better than Claude 3.5 out of the
You
box.
know, I think that the Claude products are probably better for code stuff. And I that's what I've heard from people that know more about AI than me.
That's what I've heard as well, but I've gone back and forth with the two of them. I think the biggest, well, to be fair, I put it up on very, very difficult, unfair challenges where I'll be like, generate a Frida script.
Oh,
And it'll just
snap.
start to
Yeah.
hallucinate. And I'm like, ah, man, this stuff is garbage. And then I'll be like, generate a Python script that like opens a web server and it'll do that perfectly. And obviously, so
Yeah.
I think it depends on, set your expectations accordingly, but it's still quite cool.
Yeah. Okay. So I've got this next item here on the doc, Joel, and I'm gonna talk through it really quick, but I'm also gonna go off on a little bit of a tangent, okay? From a recent hacking
You never do
experience.
that. So, and neither do I.
I'm
So.
just cautioning you, so you're not taken by surprise. Given our normal strict adherence to the doc. Yeah. Okay, so we got a write-up here from Cincinnology, from Summoning Team. He was on the pod a couple months ago, and it's a great write-up on What's Up Gold SQLi. The thing that I wanted to highlight from this, and we'll link it down below. I'm not going to walk you through the whole thing once again because, like Cinna does, it's an amazing detailed write-up of all the different code blocks and all the different techniques and thought patterns that he went through. So definitely a recommended read. I just want to pull a couple things out of this, okay? So he gets a vanilla SQLi, and I want to just say there's like this really badass quote.
Vanilla SQLi.
No, it's just like,
First of all, I haven't found a SQL injection since 2015, but keep going.
I know, right? This is crazy, dude. Like, they exist. They can find them. There's been a
It's
couple.
been literally almost 10 years since I found a SQL injection.
I
All
know,
right,
man. They're deep in there, but.
how are we not using prepared statements, folks? Come on.
Dude, and this is what he said. I'm just going to quote this thing. He says, and this leads to a vanilla SQL injection, as one would expect from such a sophisticated application. So one burned, two great bug. So not very good.
Wait,
And
real quick, real quick, real quick.
yeah.
I need to pivot back to the cursor stuff because
Joel,
this reminded me of
what
something.
are you
The
doing?
that video I was talking about, I quote tweeted it when I first saw it, and I was like, security engineers or
Yes.
what was it, security researchers rubbing their hands together. The dev develops an entire backend service without knowing how it works. This is exactly how I feel, dude.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you got this awesome sophisticated application secretly behind the scenes. Cursor, Claude 3.5 wrote this whole thing, and it did it in a way because it's like, I want to do this fast and quick, and it's just gonna work. And it accidentally created like 15 security vulnerabilities behind the scenes, but it works.
Yeah. No. I think it's great job security for us. As long as there isn't a cursor equivalent of the security
Hold on, we need to
researcher.
land some AI sponsors here. Like,
Right.
job security. I'm seeing it now.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so now that you've gone off on your little tangent, we're going back to the thing. We got an SQLi. Here's what he does with this, okay? What he ends up doing is a common SQLi exploitation technique, which is let me overwrite the master password. For this application, right? So I can just log in as the admin and get into the app, right? But in this specific application, this master password is encrypted, okay? And so it's not as easy as just overwriting the password, and you can't register an account or anything. This is an unauth bug. So what does he do? He dives deep into the encryption, figures out exactly how it works, and you can't reproduce it. It's unique to a random thing on that machine, right? But what he does instead is he finds an encryption oracle, okay? And he uses the SQLi to read an encrypted piece of text from somewhere else in the application that's in the database, extract that out, and set it as the master password for the actual user, and then proceeds to log in, right? So I just want to,
One thing I will say is
yeah.
like, this is one of those, like, you get to this point and you're like, okay, how bad do I want to destroy this application?
Yeah,
Because
exactly.
I'm about to test some things that are probably going to break everything.
Yes. Yeah. No. And this is important to note here that he's targeting an application that is offline, right? This is not a cloud instance. This is this is him on his machine with his thing. Don't go overriding all this stuff with SQL injections. It's extremely dangerous, and I've been burned by it. Tons of people have been burned by it, so please don't do that in production. But I think that this was a really unique, cool thing to do, And I wanted to sort of pivot off of the topic a little bit, because this whole concept of encryption oracles, it's very interesting and it's very applicable, I think. So there's an app that I've been testing a couple months ago where there's a big piece of their security was built off of this encryption aspect that they had. And if you were able to get around that encryption, you could really reliably attack the application. And so this
I think is pretty common, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, just like, you know, JWTs, for example, is I think like a great example where like a JWT is one key leak or one generation oracle or one arbitrary input in like
JSON
injection, like anything, like from being really catastrophic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think a lot of hackers sort of shy away from this cryptography piece because it's very math heavy and it's very like complex, and you've got to understand a lot of the various pieces of the system to be able to exploit it. But it's extremely impactful. And one of the attacks that I think is really consistently impactful, if you can figure it out, is this Oracle thing, right? If you can provide some string, and that string will get encrypted reliably, and you can get that encrypted value out, there's a lot of weird stuff you can do with that, because applications are not trusting, or they're not expecting that you can get that encrypted value, right? Yep. And so they're trusting that, and so anytime you see something like that, just like brainstorm a little bit in your brain, like how could I get this encrypted value? Where could I find this? And then actually what I did in this specific environment was I set up a Kaido workflow that took like, you know, maybe 15 minutes to write, where I would inject at a specific spot. I'll keep it to a little vague. I'll inject at a specific spot and then note, you know, where that I could tell in the response whether or not my data had been encrypted and put in the response or not. And so I think that sort of thing is, and then I navigated the app. It didn't end up panning out, but I was proud of the methodology, because I think there are very niche cases where you can get that encryption oracle and then apply it to the app, and it's really catastrophic.
Yeah, so I've got two tips on that. One is if you think that you have one, try to pad in your data with like something like a super super long string, like you know, 1,000 A's or something. And one common thing that you'll see is, you know, the response length goes up significantly when you have that encryption oracle, like, you know, the value's getting reflected in there. The other thing is with the length side of it, a lot of applications aren't expecting large, like, you know, very large JSON objects and stuff. And so oftentimes that will either break at the web server level, where it's like we're trying to return a content link that is far, far larger than it expected, or it will break at, like, you know, the library level, where it might be trying to craft the JWT or trying to craft, you know, that response token back that it's generating for you, that encryption token. Large values is really that, useful.
That length piece was exactly one of the techniques I used in that application. There's definitely inflating the size. If you theorize that you might be injecting into an encrypted context, then just inflate your input size. And if the output is also inflated, then there's a good chance that you're injecting somewhere in that. And you might be able to, you know, depending on what's being encrypted, you know, you could do, you know, JSON injection, you could do path traversals, you could do, you know, all sorts of stuff.
And this is one of my favorite things to do, you know, for like information gathering when I'm looking at an application. It's just like fuzz the inputs with different types and different things and what it's expecting. So if it's expecting a string, give it a list. Or give it null. If it's like a JSON, like give it, you know, the null type, not an empty string. Give it like extra parameters, give it invalid JSON, just try a bunch of different stuff, because eventually one of those is going to raise an error and it's going to give you something that's a bit revealing about the application, about how it's actually functioning.
Yeah, dude, when you said that, it made me think of something. I don't know if you were asleep or not, because I know the time zones didn't work super well for you, but there was a show and tell.
I didn't see it.
Let's just say there was a show and tell given, and let's just say Franz was wearing a CTVB t-shirt. And there was a shout out given to CTVB podcast for something that has been said in the history of the podcast that may have had an application. That's all I'm going to say.
Food for thought.
All right, man. Let's move along here. So one of the things that I've been hacking on lately there was an ability for me to do a file upload. And inside of this file upload environment, there was essentially a regex for the content type that of the file that you could upload, and it needed to start with image slash, and there was a regex for so that you couldn't do SVG plus XML, right? So it's not going to allow you to do XSS via that. And so I started researching some of the different cool like things you can do with content types if you have a lot of flexibility over it, like there was in this scenario. And I stumbled upon this write-up called content-type-research by Blackfan. It's a GitHub repo on GitHub. it's a repo on GitHub. And
it's a GitHub repo on GitHub. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're welcome for that. And dude, whenever I see stuff like this, I just get happy, you know, like, cause we talked about this before, right? like content type research, like that is so helpful. Because people are going deep into these things that are components of various attacks. And it contains a really nice table of, content types that can be used for XSS, and then response content types tricks, which was the thing that helped me in the scenario. So click that link and scroll all the way down.
I'm looking at it. This is so weird.
Dude, it blew my mind that this content type is valid, okay? content-type:\text/html left parentheses XXX. That will trigger an XSS. That will be parsed as text HTML, even though there's no space. It's just a left parentheses. That is a valid delimiter in the content type header.
Do you find that you have content type injection pretty frequently?
In file uploads, yes. Because what will happen is you'll upload a file, right? And they'll be like wrapping an S3 policy or whatever. And then they'll upload the thing to S3. And you can specify the content type that it should be served with when you upload it to S3. And so I often find that they're doing some sort of regex on the content type, but sometimes they just like statically say, all right, we're going to allow image JPEG, image PNG, that sort of thing.
So super cool. Yeah. No, yeah. This is great. I mean, this is one of those like meta, you know, you bookmark it and like, you know, the next time you realize that you have content type injection, you're gonna be like, oh shit, where was that?
Yeah.
Content type research repo.
Yeah, exactly. And then here's the cool thing about this too, you know, if you can get it rendered, you don't have to necessarily control so much of the body, right? You can just control some arbitrary pieces of the body. But if you can get the content type to be something that will be rendered as HTML, then you'll still get XSS. Especially when you can control the character set as well, which you can in a content type header. Because even if there's like some restrictions on what type of characters you can put in there, you can play around with the char set a little bit and get the browser to interpret it as HTML. So really cool research here. The other one I wanted to shout out, besides that weird delimiter of the left parentheses, which I never would have thought, is this first one right here, which is a multiple content type header. And one of the things I love about this repo is there's just like a link you can click to like prove it. You don't have to like just take their word for it. Like they've already prepared a link and everything. You can just click and see if it pops in your browser, and it does, man. So this is the content type header. text/plain, semicolon, x equals x, comma, text/html, right?
Yeah, my other favorite thing is that they link, for this one specifically, they link to the whatwg.org, like, HTML spec that specifically says, like, here's, like, yes, you can put multiple values in, and here's, like, the different formats that you can, you know, you can extract a mime type, like, you know, it's super interesting.
It's very nice. So even if you have like a strict regex, like must start with text plain or something like that, or and it's just not validating the char set or something like that, you can, you know, put in a comma and then add another content type header, invalidate the first one, and then you're off to the races. So I think there's a lot of there's a lot of applications for this sort of thing, knowing the nuances. And sometimes it can even result in RCE if you are uploading to an actual environment that will do server-side, you know, rendering. Like, for example, if you're able to get a PHP file uploaded or something like that. So these tricks can result in stored XSS, absolutely, very common. But also, you got to think about that bigger application as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's this is some awesome research. So I'm definitely... Maybe starring this on GitHub and bookmarking it.
Nice. Another quick thing. We'll hit the Kaido stuff and then I'll jump into another piece of really awesome research. Kaido released version 0.41. And this actually has a plugin store, which is awesome. So definitely looking forward to seeing how this helps some of the distribution in Kaido plugins. And I'm going to be uploading Expido, my Kaido plugin. And you know, maybe there's another Kaido plugin in dev right now with another guest of the podcast. So we'll see when that gets released, because it's kind of a monster. It's going to be a big one to dev, but
Yeah,
I'm on the lookout for that.
I will say as like a Kaido user, like it's
Yeah.
been very difficult for me to sort of like follow the
Development of
so
the
many like
plugins.
yeah, I mean like plugin stuff has like shifted a lot, right? So like in the beginning there was nothing, right? And then there was Even Better, which added like a way
A
to sort of
library.
like add stuff, and then they had like the plugin library, but also there's the workflow library, which I think is also from Even Better. Or no, that one's from Kaido, right? And then like Even Better also has a way to install bundled plugins or something. And now there's like an official threw something off the
Just
table.
like threw something off the desk.
Don't worry about that. And now there's like an official plugin store. So I think it might be good from the Kaido side. I know you have you've got
I've
a
got the
direct
inside
line in
hookup.
there. But it might be good for them to sort of like walk people through like the right way to do this, or maybe a good way to migrate from all those solutions to the recommended one or something. Because it does, I'm still a little bit confused about like what things I should be leaving installed, and you know, what is Even Better providing me versus the community plugin store versus the workflows library versus, you know, it's all a bit confusing.
It is a bit confusing, you're right. And that's something that we're working on with Kaido. That's something that I've talked to the team about. And I think one of the ways we're going to solve that soon, hopefully, is get a Kaido GPT out there where you can ask it questions like, hey, here's what I want to do. I want to, you know, add this specific input and look for this encrypted response in the output, right? And then it'll say, okay, you know, if that's what you want to do, then you know, XYZ, this workflow is your best bet or whatever, right? And so it should be able to provide suggestions for how you can implement various types of automation you want to see in Kaido. Like you said, Joel, I'll go ahead and add a disclaimer. I am a Kaido advisor. I'm on the Kaido team, so just to shout that out there. But I will say, we do, I and I just want to make this as a general announcement to the CTPB listeners. We do not talk about things and or advertise things on this podcast that we do not endorse, like that we haven't had experience with. We have turned down multiple five-figure deals to advertise products because we don't like the product. And so just saying, if it's coming from us, even if it's in an ad or if we're talking about it, like this is normally because we have hands-on experience with it. We know the person that's releasing it. We know they release quality work. So when I talk about Kaido, I'm talking about Kaido because I literally use it every single day. And so I'll just put that out there. So I'm excited to see where that goes. There's definitely some improvements to be made, but Kaido is moving very fast and they're getting a lot of stuff right, I think. And I'm excited to release this next plugin that I'm working on, man, because I think it is really going to change the game for Kaido stuff. All right, Joel, we got two write-ups here. Let me go ahead and introduce this first one. So the way I stumbled, let me say this. The way I stumbled upon this write-up is Orange and James, two people that I, James Kettle, two people that I have note or tweet notifications turned on for, both retweeted this write-up, right? So if you see James and Orange both retweet something, you need to go read that right now. Right. And so this is a write-up by a researcher that I hadn't really seen before, Rebane. And it is a super cool client-side chain to pretty impactfully exploit a clickjacking in Google Docs. Did you get a chance to read through this one? I know it's a little bit lengthy.
No, but I have it already. I have it bookmarked in on my Twitter. I had it liked and bookmarked already. So
before I put it on the doc.
Yes. So I remember I'd seen it and I was like, whoa, that's pretty interesting. I read the little like synopsis and I was like, that feels like it should have gotten probably more money. But that was my first reaction.
Well, it's really interesting, and I'll present it for you as well. Then it's a write-up on a bone that's a clickjacking bug, right? So this is an example. It was paid, I think, like $5,000 from Google VRB. So this is an example of a clickjacking bug that has impact. And the situation was this researcher was able to craft a Google Doc that looked like it had a Google form in it. So pretty standard, embedding a Google form in a doc. But when you clicked the button to submit the Google form, it would give you access to, or give the attacker access to the victim's all of their Google Drive, which was very impactful.
no big deal.
So right. And so there's a lot of really useful gadgets in this write-up. So that's why I wanted to cover it, because like it's great to see a really cool client-side chain. There's like three redirects chained together, and those redirects are not fixed, by the way. So it's very helpful from a gadget perspective. But it's also really, really helpful to understand like some of these features about Google Drive as well. I did not know that Google Drive had a root directory. It's just called root, and everybody's Google Drive has this. And you can grab it from like looking at your network request. They explain how to do it in the write-up, but you can grab the ID for that folder. And if you share that folder, anything you put in Google Drive is now shared with that other person.
Yeah, it's super interesting, the Google Drive like sharing permission stuff, because I mean, I know we've dealt with this a little bit from the CTV side actually, like folder sharing permissions are they like carry through, right? So like you said, like anything that gets added to a folder gets shared, and anything and anything below that folder, even like subfolders, inherit the permissions from the parent.
Yeah.
So it's like super easy to kind of shoot yourself in the foot by accident by, you know, you set like a parent folder to so everybody can access it, and then suddenly everybody can access everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So here are some of the gadgets that I wanted to shout out from this, okay? You got that root folder thing, which is very interesting. And then you've also got a super useful gadget from YouTube. And this is a redirect chain that will allow you to go from www.youtube.com, which is often used for embedding YouTube videos. In the write-up, they do a path traversal on embedding YouTube videos. So this, I could see this being very useful in other environments as well. And you land on, you can land on a Google Docs site, but you can also land on www.google.com, which we all know, if we've listened to the podcast, has an open redirect via the /AMP endpoint to get you out. So I've got a URL that I'll put in the notes for this episode that starts with www.youtube.com. and will end on my attacker controlled domain. And I can see this being extremely helpful for client side chains, very similar to the one in this report. And also for anything that is trying to parse a YouTube video. You might even be able, if it's following redirects, you might even be able to get an SSRF out of this. So definitely some impact there. I realized we got a little distracted. The actual the exploit that this person comes up with in the end is, you know, they're sharing the whole, I did say that. Okay, that's good. The whole Google Drive. And so there's lots of really cool tips adjacent to that in this write-up as well. And then let me go ahead and grab one more thing out of here that I had. okay, yeah, I remembered what it is. Dude, did you see at the end of this write-up? I'm just going to read a quote from this. Everything on this page is just HTML and CSS crafted with love. No images, no JavaScript or other resources, and it's all gzipped into 31 kilobytes. So this whole write-up, click on the link, dude. There's like, it looks like there's a bunch of images from like Google Drive in here. None of these are images. This is all, this lunatic of a person wrote all of this in HTML and CSS only. No JavaScript even.
Bro, what the fuck?
So like there are pictures throughout this whole write-up. And if you click on them, you can like select all the text.
These are like, I can undo and redo the checkbox and type in.
Right? It's crazy, right?
Bro, what is this?
It's nuts.
That's crazy.
It's very, very cool. So kind of a shout out to them, like lyra.horse is a really cool blog. And I went to go read a little bit more about this, and they have another article called Stealing Your Telegram Account in 10 Seconds Flat. And I was like, okay, what's going on here? And essentially it outlines an exploit that they weren't able to fully develop. But essentially, when you send a message in Telegram that contains a specific domain in it, it will attach the send, like the person's credentials who is receiving that domain to the link. So you click on it and you're automatically authed into the domain for Telegram related like short links and stuff like that. So one, if you're a Telegram hacker, because I know they have a bug bounty program, suss that very thoroughly, because that is super sketchy. And also, they outlined a very cool attack vector, which is like, if you send a message to somebody and you have their phone, you can get persistent access on their phone by clicking that link and then just changing the URL up at the top of the browser very quickly to a URL that you control, and it contains their auth token in it. And you're just very easily able to hijack their account in like sub 10 seconds. So I thought that was a really cool write-up. I don't think they got a bounty for it. I don't know that they even submitted it, but I think that kind of attack vector is, I think that kind of functionality is not something you really want to have in your application. So, you know, whether it be a low or a medium, I would have still reported that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that's super crazy. That's a really interesting insight that I didn't actually realize.
Yeah. Especially when it's an application like Telegram, which claims to be like super, super secure and security oriented, right? To have something like that, I think is really not a great idea. Definitely going to get yourself pwned somehow with that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All right, man. Joel, that's all I had on the doc for today. You got anything else before we wrap it up, or is that the pod?
Yeah, I think that's the pot. I got a lot of juicy notes. I gotta make sure I'm getting all my plugins from the plugin store.
Yep.
I gotta look at some content type injection. So yep. Hell yeah, man, this is good stuff.
Good episode, dude. All right, that's the pod. Peace.
Best bud. Peace.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.